Hey, it's Victoria, Girl Boss, the senior writer. And I don't know about you, but I struggle with book decision fatigue. There are just so many hot new titles and cool authors trending on BookTok, but I get overwhelmed with all of the choices. And I end up just rereading The Love Hypothesis by Allie Hazelwood for like the 17th time. I can't be bothered to choose what to read next. So that's why I joined Book of the Month, a monthly book subscription box. Their editorial team reads hundreds of new titles from emerging authors and hand selects a shortlist of their top picks every month. It's like being BFFs with an in-the-know book curator. I'm a sucker for romance, so for this month, I chose The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren. It's about a buttoned-up heir of a grocery store chain and his free-spirited artist ex who fake their relationship in order to receive a massive inheritance. Sign me up, please. I have a beach trip in June, so this book couldn't have come at a better time. I can't wait to dive in. Want to try Book of the Month for yourself? Girl Boss Radio listeners can get their first book for just $5 with code PETALS. That's PETALS at bookofthemonth.com. That's bookofthemonth.com. Buy book decision fatigue. See you never.
Hey, it's Avery, your host of Girl Boss Radio, and I'm also the founder and CEO of Bloom, an HR and DEI consulting firm, and a big believer that work should work for all of us. I am so excited about today's guest, Africa Brooke. She is an author, consultant, strategist, and international speaker with a unique focus, tackling self-sabotage and self-censorship. I discovered Africa when I came across an open letter that she wrote in 2021 titled, Why I'm Leaving the Cult of Wokeness. If you haven't read it, you should. I think anyone that navigated the social justice uprising of the Black Lives Matter movement, regardless of how you identify, can relate to the honest frustration that she shared. The funny story here is, I posted on social media that I was manifesting having her on the podcast, and one of you shared it with her, and now here we are. I actually just finished reading her book coming out in May called The Third Perspective, and to me, this book is an invitation to return to critical thinking and reduce the pressure I know we all feel to share our thoughts on inequities impacting some of our most marginalized communities. Today, I'm joined by Liz, Girl Boss's general manager, and Victoria, Girl Boss's senior writer. What did you think about the episode?
There's a line that Africa says towards the end of the episode that I think perfectly summarizes her overall thesis and her point of view, and I will just read it out loud. You're not being as intellectually stimulated as you think you are if everyone around you is saying the same thing. So this episode isn't necessarily going to teach you how to disagree or when to disagree, but it really is a reminder and almost like a really fun university lecture on what critical thinking actually is, what it means, and how to apply it in situations where that context makes sense. So yeah, I would say the biggest thing for me is don't worry, this episode is not a quote unquote duty listen, something you have to listen to then be a well-informed, good person. We really wanted to make this relatable, casual, approachable, and just real. And I think Africa has this way of summarizing complex, sometimes contradictory notions in just such a beautiful, thoughtful way.
And obviously there's a lot of polarity on social media. So it's like you're either with us or against us, you're either right or wrong, and you're immediately doxxed for not having the quote unquote right opinion. And I know I felt this way, like it kind of makes me scared to say anything on social media.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that there's a lot of people that care about things and oftentimes stop themselves from even expressing their thoughts or perspectives about something that even they may be impacted by because they're worried about the backlash that they'll be on the receiving end of. And this is true for people with small followings that are just family and friends, and even for folks that have larger followings. I've had a lot of conversations with my friends that do have 1-2 million plus followers on social media, and they're oftentimes held accountable for not speaking up about things that they do have opinions on, but they've been punished so horribly in the past that they have a deep and very real fear about speaking up and saying maybe the wrong thing or saying something that enough people disagree with that they feel like an absolute villain. And there's real repercussions to this. They're getting death threats and they're getting doxxed. They're getting their address posted online. So there's a real impact here. And what Africa shares is that it's okay to be silent on certain things if you're still thinking about it, if you're still collecting information, if you're still formulating your thoughts, or in some cases, if it is an act of self-preservation and for your own safety.
And that's the thing too, is in our chronically online world where we spend so much more time scrolling than actually interacting in the real world, we forget what people might be going through privately or processing privately or learning privately. And this makes me think it doesn't just apply to political movements or activism. I remember when Matthew Perry passed away and the Friends cast was like dogged online for not immediately posting these heartfelt super emotional tributes to him on their socials. And it's like, they're obviously thinking about it. They're obviously grieving it privately and processing it. And the last thing that anybody needs is to be bullied into putting out a premature statement or some kind of public, emotional, vulnerable share just to satisfy the masses.
Absolutely. And I think about this a lot. And one thing that I wanted to mention, because I did read her book, and she talks about how it's important for us to actually keep an open mind when we're approaching a lot of experiences, whether you are judging people for not speaking up soon enough about the death of a friend, or in this case that you mentioned, Matthew Perry, or if you are judging yourself for not having a formulated opinion about something that's going on in the world that's maybe really important to you, but you just don't know how to capture what you're feeling or how to frame it. It's about knowing that there's always more to the story. And being too hasty with sharing your thoughts or perspectives on something, or even judging someone for not doing so, doesn't necessarily hold a lot of space for growth or for understanding, or more importantly, grace, which I think we all need more of right now.
100%. Changing your mind out loud and publicly, like, it's a very scary thing to do, to admit like, hey, I didn't have all the information I needed at the time before I shared my opinion, but I've done further research and now I do. And that's a really brave thing to do. And honestly, a little BTS, you guys don't hear all of the edits that I cut myself off with while I'm speaking. And I'm like, I'm self-censoring myself before I even try to say what I want to say. I think about, oh, that doesn't sound right. And obviously I have the best of intentions, but especially on a platform like a podcast, and we have so many amazing listeners, I really admire Liz and Avery because you are so brilliant at expressing yourself. And you're definitely like my North Star when I think of what I want to be, like a better, braver speaker.
Oh, that's so sweet. Also, the magic of editing. Don't be fooled.
So on that note, in this episode, Africa and Avery talk about self-censorship, how to communicate more bravely, and the power of changing your mind out loud. Let's get into it.
Africa, welcome to Girl Boss Radio. I am very excited to hop into this conversation today. First and foremost, I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to write The Third Perspective?
I'll answer that question and I'll start by saying, this is a conversation that I was really, really looking forward to. So thank you so much for even making space for it. I wrote The Third Perspective and I'll explain exactly what it means to me. And I think this will allow for other people that engage with the book or my work to create their own definition of it. So to me, The Third Perspective is, I think of it as an invitation out of the binary, an opportunity for us to move out of this place where we feel just the immense pressure to pick a side. Prove if you're left or right, prove if you're with us or against us, prove if you're on the right side of history or the wrong side of history. Are you a safe person, unsafe person? Are you problematic or are you a saint? None of these things that I just put forward are new. However, we are experiencing them, especially with the rise of technology and the way that we engage on social media. We're experiencing them in a way we never have before. And this book, I see it as a call for common sense. I see it as a call for courage, as a call for understanding. I think the culture that we've created of fear, what we mostly think of cancel culture, but you will know that I prefer to refer to this as collective sabotage. I think that's more accurate to the experience, and I'm sure we'll go into it. But I want this book to be a solution for people that are feeling stifled in their expression, people that have started to self-censor because they are just so afraid that they're going to get it wrong. And by getting it wrong, they're going to be ripped to shreds in comment sections, exiled by their social groups. I just want us to communicate braver. I want us to realize that there is a third way, that there is always a different way to approach conflict, opposing views, and even contradictions within ourselves. And that's the shortest way that I can answer your question.
Yeah, we're going to definitely unpack a lot of what you share, but I want to take this opportunity to narrow in on something that you did mention around self-censorship. So for folks that are just learning of this, what is self-censorship?
Yes, I love that you asked that question because I always think that it's important that we're working with the same definition. So self-censorship is when you withhold your ideas, you withhold your speech, you withhold your expression in whatever form, because you're afraid that if you were to truly say what it is you think, if you were to make a mistake, if you were to change your mind out loud, you are going to be punished for it in some way. So you either completely silence yourself or you agree with things that you don't actually agree with. Maybe behind closed doors, you say how you really feel, but publicly, whether it's online or offline, you mold your opinions because you're afraid that if you stand by what it is you truly think, you'll be punished for it in some way. So it's very fear-driven. And for some people that are listening to this, they might think, well, isn't that just being tactful? Isn't that just keeping things to yourself? No, self-censorship is a very specific thing, and it's driven by a fear that there are going to be negative consequences for your expression again. It's whatever form it takes, whether you're saying something, wearing something, or a piece of art that you've created, you're afraid that there'll be a price to pay for it. Whereas social filtering is that thing that we confuse it for. Social filtering is when you use your discernment to say, actually, in the context of this situation, this is not the appropriate thing to say. It's about you taking your audience into account. Even you can see by the tone in my voice that there's a more grounded way in which I describe it. It's a more grounded, discerned experience. So I want to make sure that people understand that there is a clear difference between self-centering and using a social filter, which we do all the time.
So for folks that are familiar with your work, you have over 200,000 followers on Instagram. When did you build up this platform? When did this happen for you?
This started happening in 2016. And what I was writing about and sharing at the time was very different to what I'm sharing now. When you look at it objectively, but there's always been a through line. So in 2016, I started my Instagram account as an anonymous journal, if you will. It was to document my journey of getting sober. And I turned to the internet because I was always someone that is curious about the way in which we can connect with people that we don't know. I've always been curious about how you can find community in strangers. And when I was deep in my addiction, I realized that I didn't actually know a single sober person. But I was seeking a sober community simply for myself, and I started sharing my story. I've always been a writer, so any time that I thought I was going to start drinking again, any time that I was very close, very, very close to relapsing, or just simply entertaining the idea that maybe I've done enough time, I would write about it. And before I knew it, I had created a community. None of this was ever strategic. I had no intention to build what we call a platform. But then, not too long after that, my story got picked up by the British media fairly quickly. I would say about a year into me writing, and I was no longer anonymous at this time. But then I realized that there was a reason people were coming to me. I had a gift that I hadn't uncovered so clearly at the time, that I could take very complex topics, filter them through myself and deliver them in a very accessible way so that people could understand it. I was also able to look at my past experience and share my stories very candidly without shame. I could acknowledge the decade struggle with alcohol and drugs and growing up in an abusive home without positioning myself as a victim. And I think that was very compelling and attractive to a lot of people. I eventually got specialist training in psychology, Jungian psychology very specifically, and developmental coaching. What is the journey of taking someone in a very strategic way from the before to the after? What are the steps that someone can take to shift their mindset, to shift their behavior? And then over the course of 8 years, it's just evolved to what it is now, where I support people in the two main areas of self-sabotage and self-censorship. And now my fascination lies in moving away from the self and looking at how those things are manifesting in the collective. So that's where my work sits right now. But it always comes back to the individual, because if enough of us are self-sabotaging and we come together as a group, that's when we are inevitably going to have what I call collective sabotage. That's when we inevitably have things like cancel culture and a culture of fear and intolerance and not being able to hold multiple truths about ourselves, about other people, about the world around us. So that's the journey in which my work has taken in a very organic and unexpected way over the course of 8 years.
Yeah, and I remember the first time that I became aware of your work was when you shared an open letter, and it was titled, "Why I'm Leaving the Cult of Wokeness." And I wanted to share something with you because it's something that I definitely identified with as someone that didn't have a platform. I had like 3,000 followers and mostly family and friends and people from high school initially. And it went from that to like over 90,000 followers overnight and in 2020. I just want to share this, which came from it. And you said, "A world that tells me that because I inhabit a black body, I will forever be oppressed and at the mercy of some omnipresent monster called whiteness. Because of the color of my skin, I am a victim of an inherently racist system by default, and me rejecting the narrative of oppression means that I am, in fact, in denial. How empowering. It perplexes me that oppression is now being worn as an identity piece in most parts of the West, especially by those who claim to be progressive." And I definitely resonated with this because I lead a DEI and HR consulting firm. We talk a lot about systems of oppression, and I definitely have found myself on the receiving end of the woke mob, if you will, because I'm held to a specific standard in terms of what I talk about, the views I hold, the perspective I have. So I've really found comfort and, quite frankly, a lot of grace and forgiveness in reading your words and engaging in your work. So when you shared this, what inspired you to write this open letter?
When I read it to this day, I stand by every single word, probably now more than ever. And I can tell that's because I wrote it from a very grounded but fierce place. I wrote this because I had, without even realizing, fallen into unconscious victimhood, where I had allowed for other people to tell me how I should think, speak, behave, act as a Black woman. Not just as a Black woman, as a woman, full stop, as a left-leaning Black woman, as an ally, as a good person, all of these things that are beautiful in and of themselves. But I had started to overly identify with them to the point of them becoming a golden cage. I think 2020, a lot of people, and I know many people listening to this, will be able to appreciate the emotional charge of that year, a lot of it necessary and a lot of it unnecessary, was something that I don't think we have truly processed. And this comes from me getting sober, right? Because soon after me sharing my story and it reaching so many people, I started to get labeled as an activist. I'd always said that I'm a sobriety advocate, but I started to quickly get labeled as an activist, which was fine. And you know what, Avery? It actually felt really good because it felt like people were taking me seriously. It's a label to me that means something. So I happily wore it. Never really called myself that as much, but I understood why other people would see me. I was in many ways calling out the alcohol industry because I'd become so curious about how alcohol is marketed towards women, and I was sharing all of the things that I was finding. So it made sense. But then immediately you start to be lumped into other things. Immediately the label feminist was put onto me. Again, I didn't mind so much because if you look at my values objectively and also subjectively for me, they do align with feminism, and that's absolutely a good thing. But then I slowly realized that because of these labels, you're an activist, you're a feminist, and you're a Black activist, and you're a Black feminist, and you're left-leaning, etc., and you're an immigrant too. There was this persona that was being created for me, and it didn't feel consensual in any way. It meant that I had to behave in a certain way. So because I'm over-identifying, or other people think I'm staunchly left-leaning, that means if I agree with something that is seen as being right, I'm seen as someone to be suspicious of, right? And that's something that I write about in my open letter. But I wasn't aware of how restrictive this was becoming on my own expression. I wasn't aware that over the course of 3 years, I had started to only express things that I thought were approved in some way, things that I thought aligned with what the perfect leftist should be, what the perfect ally should be. And it was 2020 that revealed all of this to me in a way that I just couldn't unsee. Because over the summer of, I think this might have been May or June, I can't remember exactly when George Floyd was killed, a lot of conversations were sparked from that, which I think are very, very important because they've changed the way that we see the world and see our own biases. And at the same time, there was a lot of reactionary aggression towards people that just wanted to understand, people that thought they were doing their best. And part of that was this thing that I write about in my book, which you might remember too, but Black Square Tuesday, where everyone had to post this black square to show that they are in solidarity with the entire community and to do it online. But what I find interesting, and I often laugh at this, is that hours later, the same people were berated because there were now so many black squares that no one could see the information of where to actually meet up for protests. So the same people that had put this thing online without question were being punished for it. And to me, that's a metaphor for the culture that I had started to see at the time, that you think you're doing your absolute best, but it will never be enough because there's always someone waiting to tell you that you have done it the wrong way. But where the mirror was held up to me, I was one of those people, and I never expected myself to be Avery because I thought I was above it. And that's part of the problem, the self-righteousness that I had. I was one of those people demanding that people post this fucking square. I was one of those people asking, why aren't more people speaking out about this? There was a rage within me where I felt entitled to their words and for them to express themselves in the way that I was, in the way that everyone who was a good person was. So I saw my intolerance, the intolerance that had been building up slowly over the years. I just saw it in such a stark way. And like I said, I couldn't unsee it. I had a choice to either double down and to own that intolerance, but that would have pulled me so out of integrity and made me sick. I know it. And even though I was in that space of deep intolerance for probably 2 weeks at the most, it wasn't very long, but it was quite intense. It's almost like I zoomed out of myself and saw the way that I was behaving, and it was a shock to the system. And this was in late July. And that's when I started writing that letter saying, whatever this thing that has ideologically captured me, I'm not going to do it anymore. Whatever this thing is where I have to repeat certain scripts without questioning it, whatever this thing where if someone tells me, Africa, this person is problematic, you shouldn't listen to them, I just take it. And I don't question. I don't say, actually, why? Well, I don't engage with their work curiously and decide for myself. I realized that I had been in places where it mattered the most. I had been on autopilot and allowed for other people to dictate what it is that I think.
Yes. Okay. So it's so interesting because I had a very similar experience as you. I definitely was sharing a lot of binary takes on social. Some of these posts I've archived since, but they have millions of likes, lots of engagement. And I shared an article that I wrote about being gaslit in the workplace, and it went viral. And this was in April 2020. And it was in response to the Amy Cooper situation that took place. It really triggered me because it made me think about all of the white tears, if you will, that I've been on the receiving end of in the workplace. And then there was a woman that was inspired by this letter that reached out to me. And she had reached out to me about a celebrity that had been gaslighting her. And then she went, or was livid. I remember the way that I responded to this woman. I was in full support, Black woman to Black woman. We need to support each other. I didn't ask any questions. I didn't think about the nuance, the complexities, nothing. And this person went public with their story and their experience. They compared it to the Amy Cooper experience, which is much different, but it was centrally focused around this person as a white quote unquote ally should be speaking publicly about the experiences of Black folks and amplifying their voices, et cetera, et cetera. And she was instead engaging in contractual agreements that she had. This turned into national, global news, and this woman was destroyed in so many ways, stripped of different sources of employment, her job. She lost friends. She was berated and doxxed, dogpiled on in comments for months, years after this situation. And I know that it had a huge impact on her willingness to even exist on this planet. Knowing that I had some part in inspiring such egregious and violent and inhumane behavior made me sick. So it's something that inspired a whole new shift in perspective for me as a DEI leader and practitioner. And yeah, I want to get more into some of the concepts you talk about in your book because there's so much value that people can learn from this. But I wanted to share my experience because I think we've all had that. And I think that we still, to your point, we haven't healed or even come to acknowledge what, especially folks like you and I that were at the forefront of all these conversations, the impact it's had on us as human beings from 2020.
Absolutely. And I have a deep, deep respect for you for sharing what you just shared, because I promise you, Avery, not many people will share the specifics of either the change of heart that they've had or what they participated in, what they will do. And I understand it. It's a very human thing. But I think bravery and courage requires us to do things that are somewhat unnatural to us, right? And I think sharing openly how you participated either in the downfall of yourself or someone else is very, very important. because a lot of people's careers and brands, et cetera, were made in that timeline of 2020. And I'm so happy that a lot of that happened, because people that have been speaking out loud about different things, people that have been writers, people that have been speakers, people that have been on the margins of society truly could finally have their voices heard. And at the same time, it's possible that some of those people decided to take it as an opportunity to focus on a single story, because that is the single story that took them to success. And a lot of those people turn to me and my work now because they realize that they've created a golden cage for themselves. Just like you were saying earlier, they've created an audience that will never allow them to change their mind. Now they have a book deal and they have to write that book and they have to be talking about it for 3 years. If you knew how many times I hear from really well-known authors, even work with some Black authors who were signed to write a book at that time in 2020, specifically about racial injustice, etc., and the anger and resentment that they were in, and understandably so. But a couple of years later, they don't feel what they felt at that time. But now they have a contract that they have to fulfill as that version of themselves. There are so many intense identity crises happening behind closed doors. So I really appreciate what you're sharing.
Hey again, it's Victoria, Girl Boss's senior writer. I have a confession to make. I have a lot of hair guilty pleasures. I love getting blonde highlights and doing slick back buns. I accidentally fall asleep with wet hair, and I can't live without my hair straightener and hot round brush, but I often forget heat protectant. Translation, that's a lot of damage I'm putting on my precious locks. I recently made the switch to Function of Beauty's new custom repair line, powered by their US patent-pending biotech, and I finally feel like I'm doing something good for my hair. I took the 2-minute online quiz where I shared my hair type, hair goals, hair coloring, and styling habits, and got to choose the fragrance and color. And I got my unique damage score. A few days later, I received a shampoo, conditioner, leave-in conditioner, and hair mask based on my hair type and damage level. No more guessing what treatment is right for me. In one use, I noticed stronger hair, and after 1 month, less breakage. Click the link in the show notes to take the quiz and get ready for a bond repair regimen that's custom made just for you.
You're listening to My Chat with Africa. Next up, we talk about why intolerance could be holding you back from making meaningful connections with others. Wait, one more thing. Have you downloaded and rated the episode yet? Go quickly and do it right now. I'll wait. Thank you. You're the best. Seriously, it helps us so much. Also, I love hearing from folks that listen to the pod. So send me a DM on Instagram at Avery Francis so I can hear more about what you thought about this episode. Let's get back into it. In your book, you say, when we let go of intolerance, we open doors to meaningful and more interesting dialogues, deeper understanding, and greater empathy. And that really hit me. How does intolerance sneak its way into some of our most treasured relationships?
Oh, that's such a good question. And then I'd love to know your answer to this as well. To me, because a lot of intolerance is about a fear, right? We fear what we don't know, and we fear what we don't understand. And we fear the things that remind us of ourselves in a lot of ways. For example, the reason why I'm obsessed with shadow work. So shadow work is a concept that was created by an incredible Swiss psychologist called Carl Jung. And he pretty much talks about the importance of owning and seeing the parts of yourself that you repress, the parts of yourself that you would rather hide from the world, the parts that you think are messy, gross, fucked up, that if people knew this about you, they will abandon you, they will exile you. If people knew that you think this way, if people knew that you do this, whatever it might be, if people knew that you're more impatient than you let on, that you struggle with rage and anger, but you put on a smile to the world every single day, that you struggle with jealousy and possession, that you have a tendency to betray, you're not as loyal as you would like to be. So that is all in your shadow, right? You keep it behind the scenes, just hoping no one will ever, ever discover this thing. But that couldn't be further from the truth. When you repress all of those parts of yourself, you better believe they are going to make themselves known in some way. So that's when sometimes you have very extreme cases when someone that was known maybe as the quintessential American sweetheart just with a smile on their face all the time, very well presented. They don't swear. They don't do any of these things. And then suddenly a big scandal comes out and you see a side of them that you never, ever thought existed. We all have that in some way, not to the same degrees. We all have that. And there's so many other extremes. But the shadow is essentially you accepting that you're not just one person. You're not all good and you're not all bad. But when you get to know those messy parts of yourself, you learn how to manage them better. So online, we tend to have this thing where we seem to demand moral perfection, but we do it in the most aggressive and intolerant ways. So that's a direct contradiction, right, to what it is that we're saying we want. We want people to use the right language. We want people to be updated on every single thing. We want people to stand up for the exact same thing that we care about. But the way in which we demand for all of those things to happen, it shows a certain type of fear. It shows a certain type of intolerance to the idea that maybe some people just don't care as much as you do. So to me, intolerance is ultimately, it's just a fear. It's a fear of the unknown, and it's a fear of almost being seen as the thing that you're agreeing with. And we don't allow ourselves for intellectual stimulation, which is where the interesting conversation part comes in, because you're not being as intellectually stimulated as you think you are if everyone around you is saying the same thing, agreeing with the same thing, never asking tough questions or entertaining ideas that could be deemed as problematic. I'm not even talking anything extreme, but just playing around with ideas where you can make a mistake and say, actually, no, I guess I had that wrong.
How do we practice holding multiple truths at once?
I would say the first thing is to realize that you're doing it anyway, whether you like it or not. You're already doing it.
Yeah, this is true.
Right? And I think that's the beautiful thing that can actually ground you in this idea, because a lot of people actually shame themselves for being contradictory. I was having a conversation earlier with a friend of mine. She calls herself hard left. She's a socialist, a feminist. She's a brilliant, brilliant woman. And she loves Joe Rogan. She absolutely adores Joe Rogan. And it's not a recent love. She always has. She thinks he's so intelligent. She appreciates the nuanced conversations that he's able to have, the fact that he can converse with pretty much anyone. And she was saying to me, and she's in her 50s, that for a long time, she struggled with holding those truths about herself because she's known as this feminist woman who's been doing this work for decades. And she speaks to so many people every day, especially women that absolutely hate Joe Rogan. And they couldn't tell you why. They haven't listened to a single episode, but they absolutely detest him. And her and I were having this conversation today about the fact that a lot of us just need to become aware. I see awareness as the first stage of everything. Even in the book that I just wrote, it's the first pillar that you have to work with. Because once you're aware that you don't just hold it, but you're contradictory anyway, and you hold multiple truths every day, then you allow for yourself to see that you're more capable than you realize. We treat ourselves as if we're one-dimensional, but that doesn't mean we actually are. So I think that's something that even just by listening to what I'm saying now, I'm hoping that you can even start to see the difference in your mind. And as you go out into the world or when you next engage with someone, whatever, start to spot where you're already holding multiple truths, because then you can make it a more conscious practice. You can start to seek information that you think you wouldn't really agree with. And then maybe try to find even one thing that you don't have to agree with it, but it kind of makes sense. You can see where the other person is coming from. Because being able to hold conviction in something and still see where someone else is coming from, that is holding multiple truths. So I think it's realizing where you're already doing it and then making it a conscious practice in all of your interactions. I think that's a good place to start.
For me, growing up in a very multiracial environment, my dad is Black, my mom is white. I was exposed to blatantly racist white people that I loved for the better part of my childhood life. And when I reflect on that, I believe that there was a huge opportunity. I could hold space for love and acceptance for people that I knew were obviously racist, unapologetically racist. This isn't a good thing. It's very much on the extreme end, but this is something that I know I'm capable of doing. So why not expand that and practice that with others?
Yes. What I'll throw in there, because what you just shared is so powerful, is that, and you will have seen that I weave this into the book quite a lot, but it's the idea that understanding does not mean agreement, right? Because the exact example that you just gave about family, knowing that they're your family and you love them, and the racism being a part of that, it's not about you being in agreement with the behavior. You understand it, therefore you can humanize the person. Because when we immediately reject someone completely, and there's nuance with all of this, right? Which is why I say we have to use common sense and to play around with where this can apply and where it doesn't. But I think we need to be careful, because we're dehumanizing people without even realizing that we're doing so. We need to learn. I really don't think it's a nice to have. It's an urgent call. We need to become comfortable with holding multiple truths. And understanding does not mean that you're in agreement with the person's behavior, things they've done in the past, or things they will do. I think we can do our very best to understand the human condition and still set boundaries and still say, no, this is where I draw the line, and still say, this is not okay. This is what I'm okay with. And to say, these are my values, this person's values. I understand where they're coming from, but it does not align with me.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? I was on TikTok and I saw someone that said that they quit their job because it wasn't in alignment with their values. And I checked at the comment section because I'm always curious about this. And someone asked them, what are your values? And they responded with, I don't know really, but I know that this wasn't in alignment with them. And it made me laugh, not from a place of judgment, but from a place of deep understanding that I think a lot of people will be quick to say, I'm honoring my boundaries, and not know what their own boundaries are. Or they'll say,
yes,
I don't think that this person aligns with my values. And they've never taken a pause to think about their own personal values. And in your book, you share how people can actually land on and identify their values. There's a huge exercise in the book that helps people to do this. But what's one tip that you would like to share with people in terms of how they can identify a value that's important to them that will help them to be a guiding light in their life?
Yes. Oh, I love that. And the example that you just gave is a perfect way to look at it. Because if someone is saying, I don't actually know what my values are, but I could just feel that it wasn't right, or whatever it might be, typically what they're saying, because I've seen this and heard this before, is this person or this environment didn't mirror my worldview, and that makes me uncomfortable. Whereas values, they are very, very different things. You could hold the same values as someone or hold the same values as a group, and yet still express yourselves in very different way and still hold your worldviews in very different way, because worldviews are ever changing. Whereas values are intrinsically who you are as a person. Of course, they change too, but they're more tied into your identity, like the truth of your identity as a person, how you carry yourself, how you move in the world, how you treat others, how you speak about yourself and others in the world around you. And for a lot of us, including myself, until about 5 years ago, I couldn't have really told you what it is that I value. So I sympathize and empathize with that girl on TikTok, because there were a lot of things that I could just feel intuitively that I care about, but I didn't have the language for them. So for a lot of us, the values that we would list are not as embodied as we think. They are actually desired values. So if you get a clean page, put a line in the middle, embodied values on one side, desired values on one side. The ones that you think are embodied, check and look closely with an honest eye at the results in your life, and be honest about whether they are actually embodied. This is how you are every day. Or are they more desired? This is who I want to become. I think the human animal is so beautiful and so unique, because we're able to become aware of something and change our behavior if we really want to. And our behavior showed us that, oh, I had this idea that I'm all of these things, that I'm someone that values critical thinking, that I'm a curious person, that these are my values. But I've been shown that actually maybe that's not completely true, and I have some work to do and some self-reflection to do.
Yeah. So I think that a lot of people have opinions, they have beliefs, they have values, and sometimes experiences. We see people oftentimes saying, speak your truth, be brave with your stories, have a voice. I think there's a lot of pressure online now for people to show up fully and rooted into an opinion or a set of values or beliefs, and to share them loudly. And I mean, this goes back to the example I shared earlier about my own journey departing away from the toxicity that I think takes place online. What advice do you have for people that feel guilt or shame when they don't speak up or share their perspective or opinions on something that may be going on in the world that's really important? And maybe there's a critical call for people to share their thoughts and perspectives, amplify other people's voices, or draw a line in the sand and tell people, quote unquote, what side that they're on. What advice do you have for them?
I'm going to say something that I've probably said in this conversation, or maybe not as directly. Learn to hold that discomfort. I think understanding your intentions and motivations is important. Why do you feel so afraid to say something? Is it because you actually have something you want to say? Sometimes you can feel that it's true and honest and in integrity for me to say something and for me to show where it is that I stand. But that shouldn't be coming from a place of external pressure, as in, I have to say something now to prove that I'm a good person. I have to say something now so that I can show people that I'm on the right side of history. I have to say something now because it's been 6 months and this thing is still happening in the world and I haven't said anything and people can see. That's a very different thing. And if you're experiencing that, please know that there are different ways in which you can educate yourself better on whatever's happening. And it doesn't have to happen publicly. Just take on being the role of the observer and just notice that and hold that discomfort. And I actually recorded a specific episode on my podcast, Beyond the Self, called Why You Don't Have to Speak Up on Every Social Issue. And I detail that process because I think even as you and I are recording this, Avery, in real time, there is a sort of palpable feeling of needing to say something and to respond and to know exactly what's going on. And I just think it doesn't honor the complexities of so many things. But I also think it doesn't take into account that other people are doing so much behind the scenes and they're just not posting about it. But to me, it all comes back to understanding your intention and motivation, either for saying something or for staying silent. But do not cave to external pressure, because all you do when you do that, you move further and further away from self-trust. You disconnect with yourself even more. And if you think you're going to do it once, you will end up doing it again in different ways where you cave to external pressure. So please hold that discomfort and explore it. That's what I would say.
Thank you so much for that, Africa. I really appreciate it. And I think that that is a great place to end off this conversation. I think you and I could have talked for hours.
I don't know that I've ever spoken to anyone, especially a Black woman that works in DEI and is as open as you are to having this conversation. I can think of a handful actually across North America and here the UK who are just the most incredible people. But it's actually rarer than it should be that people that are in the line of work that you are willing to hold all of these very complex and messy realities about the world, you know? So thank you. Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap on my conversation with Africa Brooke. Want more? Pre-order her new book, The Third Perspective, coming out on May 14th, and check out her podcast, Beyond the Self. I love the recent episode she did about rejecting urgency culture. It is a very important listen. Tune in next week for another episode, and don't forget to rate this episode or leave a comment or send me a DM. Let me know what you thought about the episode. So many of you have, and I love getting to chat with you. This podcast is produced by Liz Goober and Victoria Christie and edited by Diego Domine. Until next time, keep blooming.